You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his latest book, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. surveillance state, Glenn Greenwald tells the story of how he, Laura Poitras, and Edward Snowden revealed one of the most important national security stories in a generation, perhaps ever. The book also includes new information about the scope of NSA activities, including a large number of previously unseen documents, and also examines what mass surveillance means for our society and democracy. No Place to Hide is published by Metropolitan Books. I'm very pleased to welcome Pulitzer Prize and George Polk Award-winning journalist Glenn Greenwald back to our show. Hello.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
And because I really want to get to the more complicated details, I'm just going to go very quickly over the things that you have been talking about, how you wound up meeting Snowden and the like, the whole business of him coming to you and you ignoring him because you just didn't want to install an encryption system.
Well, what happened was he had contacted me first in December of 2012, and for reasons that, with the benefit of hindsight, we can now see are completely understandable, he was petrified of saying anything to me about who he was or what he had until I installed this very sophisticated encryption program he wanted me to install. And the problem was that, like all journalists, I'm constantly contacted by people claiming to have huge stories, and most of the time it turns out to be nothing or craziness or whatever. And so without him telling me anything to entice me, I wasn't really prioritizing him, and that was what happened,
essentially. Well, didn't he have to walk you through encryption step by step? I mean, you've been writing about the NSA for some time. And you didn't know how to put that encryption system in?
I mean, I think just psychologically, I told myself it was a very complicated system. Wasn't very user-friendly, that you probably had to be a hacker. It turned out it's actually not true. It is difficult, but not as difficult as I thought. But it was more just that – it was more just a question of priorities. As a busy journalist, I'm working on multiple stories. To drop what I'm doing, I need a good reason, and he was unable to provide one.
Well, once you began corresponding with him, how soon did you realize that he was the real deal?
He pretty much from the beginning, I had an intuitive sense that there was authenticity to him just from the way that he was speaking and what it was that he was saying. But it wasn't but from the beginning, his primary insistence was that I go to Hong Kong to meet him. And that raised some red flags. Why would somebody with access to this kind of information be in Hong Kong of all places? And so I told him before I flew all the way across the world to meet him there, I'd want to see at least some documents. And when he sent those and they were extraordinary, even though there were just a couple dozen, that's when I realized.
And you say you were surprised by how organized his work was.
Every single document was not just put into folders, but into subfolders of subfolders of subfolders. It was elegantly organized in this way that proved that he had seen every document and put them into places according to content.
You write about gallows humor overtaking your time with Snowden in Hong Kong, including him joking about getting the better bunk when you were sent to Guantanamo.
Right. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because the reality of the experience in Hong Kong was unlike anything I had ever experienced before. It was incredibly intense. There was all kinds of intrigue and tension and difficulties in terms of how this material was going to get reported and how to protect Snowden. And so I wanted to walk through the process, and there were human moments like that, which was really about relieving the tension.
Well, do you think he was at peace with what he was about to do and how it was going to change his life?
That was by far to me the most stunning part of what I experienced in my interactions with him, not just in Hong Kong but through today, which is that although he knew that what he was about to do would likely send him to prison for the rest of his life, would make him the most wanted of fugitive from the world's most powerful government, there was this remarkable tranquility to everything that he was doing that was grounded in this conviction that what he was doing was right, that it was an act of conscience.
What about you? You've been called a traitor as well.
Well, I mean, I certainly felt the tension, but I never had any moment of doubt about whether or not I was doing the right thing. It was just more the burden that gets put on you when somebody hands you tens of thousands of top secret documents and says, I'd like you to be responsible for deciding which of these should be disclosed and how.
Well, why do you think Snowden came to you, didn't just do a WikiLeaks-style document dump on the internet or go to Julian Assange himself?
Well, I mean, that's one of the principal misconceptions is that, you know, had he wanted all of these documents that he gave us to be published, he could have done it himself. He could have given it to WikiLeaks. He didn't do that. He came to us and said, I actually don't want you to publish all these documents. I want you to go through these carefully and make journalistic assessments about which ones can be responsibly disclosed, which ones are necessary to inform people around the world about what's being done, but don't harm any innocent people. And the idea was not to destroy the NSA or the programs. It was to inform the world.
So he was trusting you to determine which ones should be released and which ones shouldn't.
Exactly.
He told you he was influenced by Greek mythology, by Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, and even by video games, because the video game somehow he saw helped him mold some moral and political consciousness.
I mean, I spent a great deal of time trying to delve into his motivation because it was a fascinating question to me, which is still fascinating, which is why does a 29-year-old do something that can send him to prison for the rest of his life, not to enrich himself, not to exact vengeance on somebody, but simply in pursuit of a political ideal? And I wanted to know that he had good reasons that were thought through, and that was part of what he explained to me.
Well, shortly after the first stories were published, Snowden revealed his identity and explained his motives in a video message. Was there just no way that his identity could have been kept a secret indefinitely?
He was convinced that his discovery would be inevitable, in part because he didn't take every step to hide who he was. He was worried that his colleagues at the NSA might be wrongfully accused. But more to the point, it was that he was determined early on that if he were going to do something this significant, that he had the obligation to come forward and say, this is who I am and this is why I did what I did. He didn't want to hide.
Well, how much did you, Laura Poitras, and Edward Snowden think about the I'm not sure if this is right, the right word, but the theatrics of all of this?
We definitely were concerned that if the world were to learn about him first through the U.S. government, either by arresting him or fingering him publicly, it would be a demonization campaign that would forever cloud how people viewed him. And it was very important to us that he be introduced to the world in his own words so that it wasn't the U.S. government but himself who could describe what he did.
So you had to develop a media strategy in advance.
Sure, a media strategy, a schedule, a very kind of elaborate dance for how that all was going to work.
Do you think that's new in journalism?
You know, I think that one of the responsibilities a journalist has is to try and make certain that the story gets out in a way that has the biggest impact. And I also think that you owe it to your source not to let them be demonized and to let them speak in their own voice.
It's been claimed that the NSA still doesn't know how much Snowden actually took. Do you think that's possible?
I know that's true. And look, this is one of the crucial points, in my view, that has been overlooked, which is the defense of the NSA is that, yes, we collect all this information, but you need not worry because it's a very tightly controlled, rigorous system where nobody can abuse it. And yet Snowden, under their noses, downloaded tens of thousands of their most sensitive documents. They had no idea that he was doing it. And to this day, they have no idea what he took. That shows how poorly managed the system is.
Do the documents he took paint a clear picture of everything that the NSA has been doing?
Not everything. They paint a really clear picture of a lot of things. They paint a partial picture of other things, and then they paint a very fragmented picture of some things. And that's why some of the reporting was relatively easy and some has been very difficult.
My guess is Glenn Greenwald, his latest book, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. The title of your book, No Place to Hide, is taken from a response made by Senator Frank Church during a Meet the Press interview in 1975. And he was saying that the government was able to collect a lot of information and we would be at a point where there's no place to hide. And that was before the internet and before so many other things that actually have made that really a prescient prediction.
Very. I mean, at the time, it's fascinating. The joke in Washington was that NSA stood for no such agency because nobody even knew that it existed, let alone that it what it did. And the Church Committee investigation of the 70s revealed this extraordinary capability that had been assembled largely in the dark. And at the time, the mandate of the agency was we don't spy on Americans, we can spy on other people. And what Frank Church said is just the existence of it is so dangerous because if it's ever directed at Americans, there'll be no place to hide. And that's exactly what has come to happen.
Well, after 9/11, the NSA did have the things in place that could have collected a lot of data but maintained people's anonymity, and they chose not to go there. Why do you think the NSA has pursued a strategy of collect it all? In just 1 month period, it collected 97 billion emails and 124 billion calls.
It's extraordinary how much they collect, and their goal really is to collect it all. And I think one reason is that if you are told that your responsibility is to prevent terrorist attacks, there's this irrational impulse that says, well, if I collect everything, I'll be able to better do that, when in reality the opposite is true. If you're collecting things indiscriminately, it's hard to find the person who's planning the Boston Marathon attack. But I think the other important thing is the history of surveillance shows that if you wield power, the more you know about the people over whom you're wielding power, the more powerful you will be. And I think ultimately that really is the motive.
When the New York Times was being asked not to reveal the James Risen stories, the Times asked Michael Hayden, well, has all of this surveillance really done much? And he said that they had found a guy who had thought of bringing down the Brooklyn Bridge with a blowtorch.
Right, right.
Even President Bush is supposed to have looked at that, looked a little askance at that.
Yeah, well, even now it's hilarious. They, with all the debate that has taken place over all these programs, the NSA has been repeatedly asked, give us an example of something you've been able to stop as a result of this program. And the only thing they've been able to point to is some guy in California who gave $8,000 to a designated terrorist organization in Somalia. And they said, because of our collect it all, we were able to find him and prosecute him. And that's the only thing they're able to identify.
There's a huge range of programs. PRISM, X, Keyscore, Boundless Informant, Pinwheel. Are all of the NSA's activities coordinated, or is it your sense that the agency may not know what other parts of the agency are doing?
It's such a sprawling agency that was $75 billion a year and tens of thousands of employees directly and through private contractors. There's enormous amounts of just duplication. It's just inept bureaucratically, in addition to all the ways it's menacing.
And you're right that there's a remarkable candidness within parts of the NSA about the true purpose of building such a massive secret surveillance system. What is it?
Well, by candidness, I mean that they talk freely and openly about what they're really doing when they thought they were communicating in private in these top secret documents, which is much different than what they say in public. And that's the reason why I wrote the book. And there's one document in particular that they call our new collection posture. And there are various phrases they use to describe what they're doing. And one of them is collect it all, which is essentially their motto. But there are others such as sniff it all, process it all, exploit it all, know it all. That's what the NSA says about themselves when they think nobody's watching.
And you just called it inept and menacing. That makes it sound kind of Kafkaesque.
Well, I mean, it's a bit almost ironically like some Al-Qaeda operatives who are simultaneously inept and yet can still be dangerous. And I think that's part of the problem is there's this massive surveillance state that can be very damaging and yet it doesn't do very much good.
You describe one document presented by the NSA and GCHQ, the British equivalent of the NSA, which detailed surveillance targets that were economic in nature, like Petrobras, the Russian oil company Gazprom, and the airline Aeroflot. Why economic targets? Are they linking them to terrorism, or have they just expanded their purview?
So much of the spying that is done is economic in nature, despite public claims to the contrary. There's a document in there that celebrates their successful invasion of the communications of all the participants of an economic conference organized in Latin America. There are, as you say, oil companies. There's a SWIFT banking system. Much of it is intended to confer economic advantage on the United States through its surveillance.
So what are they doing with this? There's one that's heads of international aid organizations, foreign energy companies, and EU official involved in antitrust battles with American technology businesses as targets. Are they sending them to the companies involved?
You know, there's a lot of the reporting that shows what they're collecting. There's some reporting that shows what they're doing with it. But, you know, there's a document in there in which they talk about motive. And they say, why do we want to dominate the Internet? What is our purpose in doing so? And they don't talk about terrorism. They talk about two things, money and power. It generates great profit to be able to dominate the Internet, and it intensifies their power.
You also reveal that the NSA routinely receives or intercepts routers, servers, and other computer network devices being exported from the United States to foreign customers, and that the agency then implants backdoor surveillance tools?
one of the documents that's newly reported in the book actually shows there's photographs of them that they took themselves and put into their own internal newsletter boasting about their success.
Unboxing a Cisco router.
And opening it, implanting a backdoor device that's undetectable to the eye, resealing the package with a factory seal, and then sending it on to the unwitting user.
Is that legal?
Unfortunately, there are almost no legal limitations on what the NSA can do to foreign nationals, and there are very few on what they can do to U.S. persons. I mean, there's no guarantee at all that U.S. persons won't end up using these routers and switches, and oftentimes they do. And so the problem is that, you know, the problem here isn't so much the NSA breaks the law. The problem is that the law has allowed the NSA to do such extraordinarily vast things that there almost are no legal limits.
Does it weaken its argument when it says – accuses the Chinese of doing something similar?
Well, amazingly, the U.S. government has been screaming for years, even held hearings and the like, about the Chinese supposedly breaking into the packages of Chinese router companies and switches and installing backdoors. And not only does it turn out that the U.S. is doing exactly that which they've accused China of doing, which is obviously gross hypocrisy, but they're probably warning the world not to buy Chinese products, so they'll buy American products instead that the NSA can then invade.
My guest is Glenn Greenwald. His latest book, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. surveillance state. It is published by Metropolitan Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Glenn Greenwald. His latest book, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. surveillance state. It is published by Metropolitan Books. You were at The Guardian when you did most of this work. You've left it, and now you work at a place called The Intercept. What do you hope to be able to do there that you weren't able to do at The Guardian?
One of the exciting aspects of new media is that you can be completely independent journalistically, which usually means that you have to start your own blog or start your own website. And the great part about that is the independence. The downside is usually you're without a lot of resources. Alternatively, if you want to have a lot of resources to do reporting, it usually means going to work for corporations, big media outlets that have existed for a long time, or you're not independent. And part of what we want to do is combine those two attributes. So create a place where journalists can be truly independent but have the resources that you need to do great journalism. And that's what we're hoping to create that's new with this new venture.
You include illustrations in this book, real documents. Is it informative to look at how these documents are presented and how they're written?
I think it's crucial. I think it's the reason why the story has resonated with the power that it has around the world. But I also just think that it's the right way to do journalism. I mean, I don't think that readers should rely on what the NSA says. I don't think they should rely on what Edward Snowden or I say. I think they should look at the evidence themselves. And the evidence, the key evidence, are the documents that Edward Snowden showed the world. And that's what makes the story.
Some of the graphics look a little silly.
You know, I mean, we were talking about the sort of paradox earlier of being menacing and being inept. And part of the NSA, their mindset sometimes is almost adolescent, and some of it is quite amateurish, but it's also very serious.
And then you have things like this from GCHQ, a thing that says, "Knowing what we have, guiding light, GCHQ has massive access to international internet communications. We receive upwards of 50 billion events per day and growing." And that's written without irony.
Well, I mean, the thing is, it's really fascinating because one of the arguments I make about the value of privacy is that people are willing to do things and say things when they think nobody is looking that they wouldn't be willing to do if they knew people were watching. And it applies to the NSA and the GCHQ, too. Those things that they're admitting in private are things they would never say in public, and the breeziness with which they say them is really striking.
You note that the NSA and the GCHQ are both, quote, "consumed by their perceived need to monitor internet and phone communications of people on commercial airline flights." Why are they so focused on that?
This is, you know, the key point is that there wasn't any incident where someone plotted on an airline and they weren't able to access the communications, so now they wanted to. It's really reflective of this institutional notion that there should never be any place on earth that you can go and communicate without there being able to invade your communications. And the fact that you can go on a commercial jet for a few hours and make it difficult for them to hear what you're saying drove them crazy. And they spent hundreds of billions of dollars or tens of billions to be able to get a comprehensive system to cover in-flight communications just for that reason.
You write about a program called Thieving Magpie. What does that do?
The Evening Magpie is essentially a way of invading in-flight Wi-Fi services as well as cell phones, the phones that are embedded onto the back of the seat, and then to be able to trace who's speaking to which particular seat so they can identify the passenger who's using the communications.
There's also an NSA program called Homing Pigeon.
Right, which is similar. It's sort of the NSA version of the in-flight scrutiny.
Why do you think it's important to reveal diplomatic espionage that's been done by the NSA?
Well, first of all, I mean, the diplomatic espionage involves things like Susan Rice calling the NSA and saying, we're going to negotiate a new resolution with the Security Council and the General Assembly. I need you to tell me what they're saying internally so I know what their negotiating strategy is and what they're really willing to do. And
so this continues into the Obama administration.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Susan Rice is a very prolific user of the NSA. And you know, I think that there's, you know, people can debate whether that's appropriate or not. But the idea of the UN is the countries are supposed to come together and resolve in good faith their conflicts. And if the United States is exploiting the presence here of the UN to listen to people's communications, that sort of undermines the purpose.
Well, of course, they say everyone spies.
Not to the extent and not with the sort of aggression that the U.S. does.
But the confusion I have, and this also brings me back to the economic spying, the justification that we hear again and again for all of these programs is to protect us against terrorism. And yet we are spying on German Chancellor Angela Merkel. I don't think anybody suspects her of being a member of Al-Qaeda.
Or the Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff, and, you know, and the Mexican president as well. I mean, that's why those stories had such resonance, because it gives the lie to the NSA's claims.
And some of your more disturbing disclosures concern the GCHQ. You write that the documents reveal that the GCHQ engages in online covert action against people they've designated as hacktivists, designed to disrupt, degrade, and discredit their online presence.
There are shocking documents that at least shocked me from the GCHQ talking about using what they call honey traps, where they use women or what appear to be on the internet women to lure people into compromising situations who they believe are expressing ideas that are threatening to the British government.
We're talking about perceived radicals, not necessarily jihadists.
Not jihadists. People they say are not involved in
so
terrorism.
It's like COINTELPRO?
Exactly
that
it's exactly like COINTELPRO. They do things like – there's an NSA document that talks about collecting the online pornographic activities of people who they believe express radical ideas, who they say are not terrorists, not involved in plots, and discussing how it can be used to destroy their reputations.
And the NSA does something similar. You have a Snowden document from October 3rd, 2012, which reveals that the agency's been monitoring online activities of individuals they feel express radical ideas and have been radicalizing others.
And have collected their online sex chats and their visits to pornographic websites.
And how do they define radical in those cases?
That's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, people look back at the 60s and 70s and say, oh, that was so outrageous. But back then, the groups like civil rights organizations, the anti-war movement was considered radical. That's how governments view those who oppose their policies as being both radicals and threats, and that's what makes these programs so dangerous.
On the other hand, do you think that the threat of terrorism has been overblown? Is it difficult to make the case that the threat of terrorism might be overblown in a post-9/11 world?
There's no question that threat has been wildly exaggerated. I mean, if you look at just on the numbers, Harper's in 2010 had a statistic that said the number of Americans killed in the prior year due to terrorism, 8. The number of people who have been killed by lightning strikes, 29. There are all sorts of statistics that show that more Americans die of intestinal illness than terrorist attack every year. The threat has been entirely manipulated and exploited to justify increasing levels of power in the U.S. government.
You write that the true measure of a society's freedom is how it treats its dissidents and other marginalized groups. Using that metric, how would you assess the United States and its treatment of someone like Chelsea Manning, for example?
It's a great example. I mean, you know, I think there's a tendency for people to say, I'm a normal person, I go to work, I don't bother anybody, and therefore I'm not really threatened by any of these problems. And I don't think that's the right mindset, because what that's essentially saying is, as long as you're somebody who doesn't challenge the government, who doesn't threaten anybody, who doesn't express controversial ideas, then you can be left alone. But someone like Chelsea Manning, who comes forward, harmed nobody, informed the world about American war crimes, is now in prison for at least a decade, was treated inhumanely and brutally in detention as well.
Do you escape any of this because you don't live in the United States these days?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the visibility that I've been able to do the reporting under has been protective. I think my living in Brazil certainly helps in terms of being able to do the reporting fearlessly.
Are you able to live a normal life in the midst of all of this?
No, there's been definitely nothing normal about my life for the last 10 months.
You'll ever have one?
I'm hoping. I'm not too optimistic, but I still do harbor some hope.
So do you see yourself as an exile to some degree?
Originally why I lived in Brazil was because there was a law in place that barred my partner and I from moving here because he couldn't get immigration rights under the Defense of Marriage Act. That law has been struck down just recently, but certainly for the last 9 years, I viewed myself as an exile. I didn't feel safe coming back to the U.S. as I did this reporting. U.S. government senior officials in the Obama administration were threatening arrest and threatening to criminalize what we were doing. Now I do feel safer, so I wouldn't call myself an exile at all.
I'm talking to Glenn Greenwald, whose latest book is No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. You describe the FISA court, one of the entities tasked with overseeing the NSA, as a cosmetic measure, useless. In what ways do they fail?
Well, first of all, it's a court and only in name only. It doesn't have any of the attributes that we think about constitute a court. It meets in secret. Only the government is permitted to attend and to be heard. And if you just look at the numbers in its 30-year history, they have approved U.S. government requests to eavesdrop on Americans, I think, something like 35,000 times. They've rejected a grand total of 7 requests. It is the ultimate rubber-stamping court.
I want to know what those 7 requests were.
They must have been really extreme.
You're also extremely critical of the congressional committees that are charged with NSA oversight. And you write, the chairs of the congressional committees have sometimes defended the NSA even more vigorously than the agency's officials themselves have done.
One of the things that happened in the after the 70s, when people were so alarmed by what J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and the NSA were doing, was they created the appearance of reform but not the reality, including by the FISA court that they said, oh, don't worry, there'll be this court. But in reality, they built it so it never did anything. Same with these committees. They created oversight committees and then put people like Dianne Feinstein, who is an enormous loyalist to the CIA and the NSA, in charge of the committee, or Mike Rogers in the House.
Do you think that'll change now that Dianne Feinstein has expressed outrage at the CIA for spying on her staff?
You know, it's interesting how politicians, the ones who defend the NSA most vigorously, suddenly get angry when it turns out that they themselves are being spied on as well. But no, I don't think Dianne Feinstein will ever change her loyalty to the national security state.
Do you think that journalists, especially investigative ones, should take extra steps to protect their correspondents?
I think it's the obligation of anybody who works with the need to have their communications confidential, including lawyers or human rights activists and definitely journalists, to use basic encryption to protect their communications. And the NSA actually cannot invade good encryption, so it's definitely something they should use.
So that means I'm going to have to start learning how to do encryption?
We'll get you a tutor and help. You'll learn it in one day. If I can learn it, anybody can learn it.
Well, you've been very critical of the mainstream media. But haven't they revealed all sorts of things like Abu Ghraib, waterboarding, the existence of CIA black sites, the warrantless wiretapping program? They've reported on the Afghan and Iraq war logs. Aren't those examples of a vigorous and adversarial press?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can take each of those cases and dissect them. You know, certainly my condemnations of the American media recognize that there are good reporters working in even the biggest media organizations. But if you look at the NSA warrantless eavesdropping cases, for me, the best example, the reality of what happened there is that Jim Risen and Eric Lichtblau at the Times learned of that program in 2004. Then the Bush administration summoned the editor and publisher of the New York Times to the Oval Office and said, you cannot report this. They therefore forced those reporters to sit on the story for 15 months. Risen finally got so frustrated with the Times that he wrote a book in which he was going to break his own story, and only then did the Times publish it and then revel in the Pulitzer Prize they won. And that is sort of illustrative of how closely the government works with these media outlets.
So why do you think that is? Watergate was a totally opposite kind of story.
And, you know, I mean, for one thing, there's a lot of benefits. If you have a lot of good relationships and friends in the government, you get all kinds of scoops. You get information. A big part of it has been the corporatization of the U.S. of the American media. So when you have a huge corporation like Comcast that owns, say, MSNBC, they have enormous amounts of dealings with the government that they want to keep friendly relationships with.
Well, the government told the New York Times, told Bill Keller and other people from the Times, I think Sulzberger, that if they did reveal the things in the Risen Lichtblau book, that they would have blood on their hands.
Right.
That the disclosures might harm the United States or the security of people who live here.
Don't you worry about that? They say that every time. That's their job, is to keep things secret that they've done wrong and don't want published. And the responsibility of a journalist is not to blindly and uncritically defer to that fear-mongering. It's to investigate it and demand evidence for it. The government, in this case, in our reporting, has said that in almost every single story, and yet none of that has come true. And I think that's what real journalists do, is they scrutinize government claims rather than blindly assuming them to be true.
Now, much of this has been contracted out. In fact, Snowden wasn't working for the NSA, was he? He was working for as a private contractor?
Yeah, he worked for the Dell Corporation and then for Booz Allen, which was the ultimate last job that he had. And, I mean, most of what our government does in the national security realm has been now privatized. So instead of going to war with an army, we go to war with Blackwater. Instead of doing surveillance with the CIA or the NSA, we do it through Booz Allen.
And what's the argument for that? Doesn't it cost more to have a for-profit company to do the work?
The people in government who make the decisions about how things are done are people who previously were executives of these corporations and who in the future, when they leave government, will once again become executives. There's an enormous profit motive.
So this is like lobbyists who go – Congress – people who become lobbyists and lobbyists who become – politicians?
It's a constant revolving door in the national security world. A huge part of what we're talking about with surveillance is not just about power but about profit.
So, to what extent should users trust companies like Facebook and Google with their personal data? Is it being collected by the NSA?
Oh, absolutely. I would not trust my personal data to Google or Facebook. In part, it's because the law mandates that they turn over large amounts of the data to the NSA. And in part, it's because, at least until these stories began surfacing, they actively and eagerly cooperated with the NSA in much of what they did that beyond what the law required.
What do you think is going to happen with Snowden? He's living in Russia. Russia right now is having rather tense relations with the United States. Is he going to be trapped there for the rest of his life if he decides that he doesn't want to come back and face possible charges?
Well, he's already been charged in the U.S. It would be almost certain prison. He has a year of asylum in Russia that's going to expire in September. There's strong indications the Russians are likely to extend it. And there's also active debates in countries like Germany and Brazil over whether they ought to extend asylum to Snowden in recognition of what he did for their privacy rights.
To you, is the real danger of mass surveillance, even if it isn't being abused, that people begin to internalize the fact that they could be watched at any time for any reason?
That's the critical part of what the surveillance
state does. This is like 1984?
Yeah. In 1984, people, I think, sometimes forget that the monitors that were in people's houses weren't watching them 24 hours a day. In fact, there's a passage in the book that I quote from 1984 that says, in fact, we didn't know if we were ever being watched. The point of it, though, is that when people know they can be watched, they have to assume that they're always being watched and then act accordingly. And there's all kinds of studies that say when we know we're being watched, we become more compliant. We become less free.
Well, how much of this is a real threat to American democracy?
Well, first of all, just the fact that this was all done without anyone knowing about it is itself a very strong indictment of the health of American democracy. The fact that something this extraordinary and profound was undertaken by the U.S. government completely in secret with no debate or knowledge on the part of the citizenry. But the existence of the surveillance state itself, you know, as every tyrant has recognized, keeps a population in line, which is a huge threat to democracy.
Are you concerned that you might be charged with violating the Espionage Act? People have called for it.
Sure. I mean, top officials in the Obama administration have called for it. And so it's definitely a concern, but not one that's going to in any way deter the reporting I'm doing.
Should we be expecting more revelations? And are there other things out there that are still to be released?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the story that we're working on now is, I think, one of the most important by far. It'll be one of the most explosive. And obviously, the new stories in the book, I think, really are ones that inform how we understand these issues as well.
In an interview with GQ, you mentioned that this whole thing is going to be turned into a movie.
There's actually, yeah, I think there's an announcement coming today about that, actually. I know when I was a kid, All the President's Men was hugely influential in how I viewed the world, and so hopefully there'll be people engaged similarly by that movie.
Well, we've learned that All the President's Men didn't always stick close to the truth.
It did not, that's true, but I hope hopefully this film will. The book certainly does.
Glenn Greenwald, his latest book, No Place to Hide, Edward Snowden, the NSA, and the U.S. Surveillance State. It is published by Metropolitan Books. Glenn, thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.